Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, you can press the number 1 on your telephone keypad and you'll be placed in the queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into our chat room and pose questions there. I'm extremely excited about today's show. Minor Differences is a documentary that was released a few months ago. It chronicles the life of 5 boys who were sent to a juvenile maximum security facility called Green Hill in the state of Washington. The film explores the impact of their exposure to the juvenile justice system and records their journeys and struggles over a 15-year period. Joining us are the filmmaker and 3 of the boys, now men, who were part of the film. Filmmaker Heather Dew-Oakson wears 3 hats as a media artist, independent producer, director, and a professor of new media at Cornish College of the Arts in Seattle. Educated as a social anthropologist and urban planner, her process moves beyond pure documentation by using aesthetic tools and forms that enable a deeper consideration of the content. Heather's work challenges viewers to see social issues in new ways through altered scale, sequence, light, and point of view. Joseph Downs, who likes to be called Joe, was born in Seattle, Washington, and raised by a single mother. He was first arrested at age 15. He was sent to Green Hill at 16 for a juvenile life sentence. He struggled after his release and was in and out of prison for the next 8 years. He recently completed a school program for accounting and through that will try to chase his passion for social justice by getting a degree in social work. Casey Stentz describes himself as a 34-year-old ex-felon. He was sent to Green Hill at age 16 for robbery after spending 1 year in juvenile custody for a minor drug offense. He has since broken the recidivism rate by never stepping foot back into a cell. Casey now spends his days as a project manager for a structural engineering firm and is a Brazilian jiu-jitsu instructor in his free time. Matt Stafford was first arrested at age 12, which is also when he started to abuse drugs and alcohol. He was sent to Green Hill for a shooting that occurred during the commission of a robbery. After being released at the age of 21, Matt returned to his addictions and a life of crime. At the age of 25, he was sentenced to 72 months in federal prison for firearms possession. Released in 2009, Matt is currently a self-employed starving artist. So I'd love to welcome all of you to the show today.
Thanks, Lauren.
How are you doing, Lauren?
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, I'm really pleased that you're here. So, Heather, why don't we start with you with a little background on the film. What led you to Green Hill and to making this film?
Well, in 1994 in Seattle, there was a pretty horrific drive-by shooting. And at the time, my son was also 15 years old. And it just occurred to me that nobody knew what to do and how to think about it and how to make change. And at that point, I had a nice opportunity to work in some juvenile facilities as an artist. And when I got there, I kept hearing these amazing stories from these young people. I mean, they were maybe 12 to 15, and they were so articulate. And as a filmmaker, I thought, well, I have to go beyond teaching painting and drawing. I want to make a film. And as luck would have it, I had the opportunity to go to Green Hill School, which is the maximum facility for juveniles, corrections in the state of Washington, and the superintendent told me if I could teach a video production class with this equipment that was sitting in storage and no one knew how to use, that I could have free range to make my documentary. And so it began. I wanted to do something that was more than a news bite, so I intended to follow whoever I ended up sort of engaging with and sort of relating to in that way. I thought, well, I'll follow them for about 4 years, which I did, and I made sort of a previous here's what happened then film in 99, but there was no internet, there was no way to really get the word out. So though I stayed in touch with all of them, it wasn't until about 5 years ago with the internet possibilities, and I just felt like their situations had become so much more dire that mass incarceration had increased astronomically, that I just knew I had to get back into it and see where they were today. So that's what Minor Differences is now, is that, you know, 15 to 18-year-olds turning into 35 to 38-year-olds. So that's where we are today.
Great. And I watched the entire film, and so most of my questions are based on that, and I want to hear from all of you. You know, feel free to respond. Matt, in the film, you mentioned that you went into Green Hill as a kid with addiction issues, and then you left knowing that there could be a career in crime. And I think, Casey, you also struggled with chemical dependency issues. So what role did addiction play in your criminal behavior, if any?
I mean, it played a huge part in it, as it does, I would say, with the majority of the population that is incarcerated. I mean, that, you know, our jails deal with so many different issues, mental health, addiction, you know, and that's kind of where it all ends up. That's the prison system is our catch-all. So it played a huge part for me, and I know it did for most everybody else.
It was absolutely a factor for me as well. I feel like my addiction was more a symptom of the total problem, but absolutely, addiction went right hand in hand with all my criminal activity as a kid.
And Joe, you really focus more about the economics of motivating you to commit crimes, and I know we still hear from youth, especially from urban areas, saying that is a big motivator. Can you say more about that?
As far as how I view it, economics usually puts you in a position where, as a kid, you want to earn, you want to do more. Me being African American, sometimes faced with different adversities, I believe, than other people would be. And so if you get caught into the system and now you have, let's say, strike against you already because you're African American, strike against you because you're an ex-felon, it seems like you never can catch up in the economics. You're usually just stuck in dead-end jobs or, you know, low-paying jobs, because those are the ones that usually you can get. But as far as the economics go, I mean, it's got to be an equal playing field for all of us, and it just hasn't been.
Can I chime in?
Yeah, you know, it would be really helpful, I think, for our listeners if you can, for a while at least, identify yourself when you first speak, if you can do that.
Sorry, it's Casey. I apologize.
No. Go ahead, Casey.
I agree with Joe 100%, and I would say economics was the primary reason that I was committing, doing the things that I did as a youth. When you don't have a place to stay or you don't have a reasonable way to feed yourself, you will find a means to do so. That's why I said the addiction thing was kind of secondary for me. I was more focused on trying to put a roof over my head and food in my stomach, and that's why I did what I did.
And Casey, you were actually transferred to the adult system as a youth, as a child. So what impact did that have on you? You know, what was it like as someone under age 18 walking to adult prison system?
Oh, it was terrifying. Yeah, it was a terrifying experience, and I was singled out. Luckily, I found some friends in there in the situations where I could do the same things I was doing on the street as a means to survive and get myself through the time. And once I was back out on the street, I was still young enough, 19, of Caucasian descent, so I didn't have the same adversities or limitations that like Joe had, and I joined the union, which is really my saving grace, is I had the opportunity to make a reasonable living when I stepped out of the system.
Yeah, and so this is Joe, sorry, just chiming in. So you didn't have to go back to a life of crime, where opposed me, I was in there for a while, but I got a taste of the adult prison system in between my juvenile travels. And for me, going coming from a situation of being locked up for so long, I wasn't afraid at all, actually, when I stepped into the – it was kind of like – this is kind of like going from high school to college.
And graduating.
And,
yeah,
graduating pretty much, you know. And it actually is like that in the system. You'll graduate from the juvenile system to the adult system and then finally get to the federal system, which is basically college. And so,
Masters.
You get your master's degree in there. And so it all ties into, like you said, you had the opportunities, you had that choice. I didn't have that choice. I didn't, you know, so that's probably why I struggled so much.
And I really do want to hear from each of you sort of, you know, your ideas, too, to how to stop that progression through the correctional school system. But you were talking about passion. I mean, Casey mentioned, you know, getting into the union. And through the film, you can see each of you really did have something that has helped you survive. Joe, you had chess, Matt, art, Casey, martial arts. So can you share, how did you discover the passion, and how can this be facilitated for youth, whether in communities or inside also the juvenile facilities, through programming to help foster rehabilitation?
This is Matt. As many programs as they could get into the juvenile system, which, you know, you would think would be easy because it's the juvenile system, the security concerns might be a little bit less, so you'd think they could get almost any program that they wanted to in there, and they should. They should get every program that's ever applied for in those gates, because anything helps. Kids are still kids, regardless on if they're in society or behind a fence. And, you know, last time I checked, part of adolescence is figuring out what you want to do with your life. And as much exposure as you can get to as many different things is always a good thing, I think. So
yeah, you got
to me, it just makes sense to do that.
Got to be able to express yourself. See, that's the thing about a child. When you're locked away, you don't know how to express yourself. You don't know how to think outside the box as far as, you know, yeah, I'm going to be an adult someday. I might need to start thinking adult things. I mean, even if you were just being able to play chess, to think three steps ahead is what you're supposed to do when you play chess. So it really gives you a avenue on working your brain. Art gives you a way to express yourself, and they don't have those programs even in, you know, juvenile facilities. And like Matt said, it would be, you know, it would be behoove them to go ahead and take advantage of, you know, the internet and all that stuff that they could, you know, as a juvenile, they could be able to express themselves and explore.
Because one way or another, things are going to get learned in there. I mean,
right.
People aren't just going to sit around and stare at the wall. You know, things are going to be learned and habits are going to be picked up. And if they don't take it upon themselves, meaning the authorities or the quote-unquote system, to put positive things in there for people to be learning and picking up and habits to be recreating when they get out, then what's going to continue to happen is just going to keep going, because, you know, it speaks for itself. I think everybody involved in the film ended up involved in the adult system. So,
well, I will say, though, in agreement, this is Heather, with you all, that one of the things, whether the different interests that you have really helped redefine your own image of yourself. There's so much emphasis on being a felon and being a, you know, an incarcerated youth, that pretty soon that's how people start thinking of themselves. When you get to be in an arts program, suddenly you're not labeled. You have a different way of seeing, oh, I'm an artist, I can draw, or I'm a musician, or I'm a smart, strategic thinker, whatever. There's just that option of broadening yourself so that when you get out, you don't see yourself as this person who can't do anything but be a criminal.
Who just didn't sit around and do nothing.
Yeah. Right.
And so just...
Yeah, you're completely opposite.
Again, it might be interesting for our listeners to know, did you walk in to the system with these interests? How were you introduced to give people ideas? Was it, you know, someone who took an interest in you while you were there to that taught you art or taught you chess? How did you find out about these things and find your passions?
Well, this is Joe.
Go ahead.
Joe, yeah. Well, for me, it was just like I said, I was trying to pass the time. I needed to do something with my mind. There was a lot of things, like Matt said, I could try. I could have tried, you know, all the criminal aspects of being in jail. I could have did all those things, but I just needed to find some kind of passion for something for myself to do. I read, I play chess. It was really just a way for me to occupy my mind, because there's so much idle time in there. You have to find something. And some people pick up drug habits. Some people pick up books. Some people pick up chess boards. It's really, when you're in jail, you really find you have time for yourself. So I don't know, Matt, you were saying?
I think it's like anything. I mean, it's you're still alive in there. So it's just like life. It's just life with a reduced intake, you know. You're not seeing as much or doing as much, but you're still alive. So how does anybody find an interest that they have? It just kind of, it grows. It's like, personal interests and personal habits and personalities are kind of like weeds. They'll, even in concrete, they'll find a crack with a little bit of dirt to grow in. And the human spirit is like that. So.
Were you an artist, though, before you got in there, Matt? Didn't you make, weren't you doing some kind of
sprinting? Yeah, I mean, I always... doodled or did something, kind of trying to work on that. But as Joe was speaking to, you have a tremendous amount of time on your hands, so there's more time to explore, stuff like that. It's really, that's why prison is so hard, especially kind of for the Western mind, is we have a hard time dealing with ourselves, and that's what you're forced to do when you're incarcerated, which is really hard to do as an adolescent, because... I mean, if anybody has any good recollection of their youth, it's, there's a lot of hormones and stuff going on. And self kind of introspection is difficult to do at any age, but, and especially under those circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matt, Casey, Joe, you're joining us today. Heather, there were two other boys, Travis and Andy, that were part of this film that you followed. Where are they now?
Well, Travis, who's Native American, he's an Assiniboine Lakota Sioux, and he is at Airway Heights Correction Center in Spokane for a very long time. He has a 54-year sentence, but I will say he has turned his life around completely and has become an amazing mentor and cultural leader wherever he has been stationed, I wanted to say. Anyway, wherever he's been placed, and due to privatization of the prison system, he's been moved from about 6 or 7 times in a matter of 10 years to Oklahoma, Arizona, Nevada, and I can't even remember the couple of the other places. But he's, for someone who is in as harsh a situation as he is in, he has managed to turn that into his own advantage, that self-reflection that Matt was talking about. And I think he feels at least he has a purpose, which everybody searches for. Andy has had a pretty rocky road of it. He hasn't gone back into the state prison for a while. But he has had trouble finding a life for himself that makes sense and getting out of the community that he was in just kind of keeps forcing you back into the ways that you're familiar with and the jobs you can get. At this point, he's 37 and he doesn't have any employment record. But recently he moved to Oregon, and I think he's really making an effort to stick with it this time. So I'm more hopeful than I have been.
We do have a question from a listener, and I think it goes out to all three of you. Was there anything that could have been changed about what your treatment or in the juvenile system that would have maybe prevented you from going into the adult system?
Yeah, I mean, a complete rearrangement of the system. It's a, I mean, it's just the current juvenile justice system in this country is just a, it's an incubator for the adult system. I mean, it's almost a guaranteed trip to the adult system. So redo the whole thing. Involve actual schooling, actual training, actual mentor programs. You know, treat them like human beings. But
yeah,
that's not what happens.
Yeah, this is Joe, and I believe that with you being a juvenile, you're going to be an adult someday. You're going to be a man or a woman. So you should really, the system should really prepare those young minds for that. May it be through schooling or may it be through just educating them on the opportunities that they will possess once they're out of here. See, nobody said anything as far as what's going to happen with me besides don't come back to jail. You're going to end up back in jail if you don't do this. That's the only thing they said. They never said that I can do this. I can go on and be a welder or anything. No, those possibilities weren't. I mean, there were some possibilities when I was in the juvenile system, but for the most part, they don't prepare your mind for the world, and that's what you're going to step out into.
Well,
no, agreed. This is Casey, and if I could weigh in, I would argue the same thing that Matt is. It calls for a complete restructuralization of the system, or restructuring, excuse me, of the system, because the system is set up right now not to put people back and put them functioning and being a good taxpayer like everybody else in society, but it's creating slaves, it's creating felons, it's creating Class A felons, and that's what the system's designed to do now. So it needs to be completely rethought.
And because I think it's helpful for people to really understand is to give some examples. So anything you're comfortable sharing about maybe some things that were really traumatic for you. You know, you talk about treat us like human beings, but what happened? Can you give some examples of how you were treated so that people can, you know, really understand what you're talking about? And Heather, feel free to share things, you know, that you saw that maybe shocked mm-hmm. you, that you really didn't know were going on, you know, because these were kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is Matt. From the beginning, you when you are first locked up, you're stripped naked, and you know, then you show them your rectum, you know, and that's irregardless of age, you know. I mean, and for the most part, you're dealing with children, and lots of them are coming from circumstances where things haven't been so good. That's part of probably why they're acting out in one way or the other. And, I mean, just from the initial point of entry can be traumatizing for a kid. But, I mean, you're really housed like an adult criminal. I mean, the differences are very slim between the juvenile system and the adult system, and that just doesn't make sense to me because you're dealing with children. So the entire thing is traumatizing.
I actually think the thing that amazed me the most was when I was there and happened to be at the visitation day, you know, on the weekends, and they have these very limited hours that your family or certain people, I mean, it's a giant rigmarole to even get on those lists. Once you've done 10 pounds of paperwork, you get there, and it's so humiliating. And the people treat you like you're some sort of criminal, the visitor, as though you're the criminal. And then it's just... It creates this really super controlled, down situation. And it's hard enough for people to travel 2, 3, 4 hours to get to see their family, and they get to spend 5 minutes, and they're patted down, and you can't wear this. It's just super humiliating. And I don't think most of the public knows that. I didn't. You know? So it extends to the families as well as the individual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think that the people realize that, like, in these juvenile facilities, that the staff that are there, there's staff members, and then there's also counselors. They're supposed to be, like, counselors, but they're actually just, you know, they're herding cattle. They're making sure no fights break out. They're making sure, you know, nobody's raped in the shower or anything like that. But at the same time, they're not counseling. They're not there to say, hey, okay, what's going on with you? How are you doing? How are you taking this? They're not asking about your families. They're not really involved with you. They're just there like staff members. And like Matt said, they're just there really to prepare you for the adult system. So, I mean, the horror stories are, they're far and few between. There's really nothing too much going on, but a bunch of, you know, boys sitting around trying to figure out who's a man amongst boys in a world that none of this matters, you know. So,
well, the system's great at doing the, you know, the rename game. They take feces and tell you it's honey. Like at the juvenile facility when we were there, they would call the housing units cottages. They,
right.
You know, they take one word that in your mind conjures up one thing, but it, the reality of it is another, you know. And they're, you know, the system's been doing that forever. It's, you know, why is it bail? It's really ransom.
And I think it used to be more, somewhat more progressive back in the early 90s when I first got there. I wouldn't be able to have made this film now. They wouldn't let me within, you know, 10 feet of the gates. And there was a lot more, there were more programs. The reason that I initially found out was the Experimental Gallery. That kind of program brought writers and artists into the system to help students see themselves differently and give them an idea of their own voice to be able to reflect. I wouldn't say much for the education part of it. But, so, I mean, I think things have gotten even, as Matt says in the film, it's become an adult prison
mm-hmm.
with circumstances most adults couldn't handle. So.
And go on.
Sorry, this is Stacey. I'm just, like, trying to scan my brain for the many different horror stories that I can remember from Green Hill, which they name, like Matt's explaining, Green Hill School. There's not much school involved in it at all. In fact, I'd suggest less than a single percent. But I remember going to an intensive management unit, which was pretty much 23 hours in your room and 1 hour out. I don't know if anybody listening has been in isolation, but it's hard enough as an adult, let alone for a developing mind. I remember a kid that was locked in there who would talk to spiders outside of his window and rub feces all over his cell and was obviously not of the mental capacity to deal with the situation he was in, but there was nothing for him. There was no programs. There was no education. There wasn't any counseling. There was people there to shove food in his door and clean up when he made a mess, and that's a tragedy.
Thank you all for sharing those stories. I mean, I know these are things that you live with every day in your memories, but it's not necessarily something you want to focus on. But I think it is important for people to hear, you know, what is happening or not happening there. And I do want to remind our listeners, if they want to ask questions live on air, to call 347-994-1149, and then you press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. In some of those examples, you were talking about families, the role of family. Family engagement, we know, is extremely important. And the absence of that has an effect. And also, being engaged has so much potential. So in the film, Casey, you discussed the void that you know, of not having parents in your life, that you were homeless by the age of 14. And Joe, it highlights, you know, you have children. And so, you know, what was the impact of that and the motivation of having children? What is the role of family? What can we do better? How has it helped you?
I mean, family is, it's not encouraged. Like Heather kind of spoke to the hoops that have to be jumped through for visitation, which is limited. And I would say that the majority of kids involved in the system, at least back when I was in there, were coming from, I mean, there was some sort of dysfunction of manifesting itself in one form or another in everybody's family. So it's not like this was the Cleavers and then all of a sudden Beaver goes to prison. And, you know, they all pull together
they
and make
up.
It work, and it's, you know,
yeah.
It's all solved in a half-hour episode. It's, you know, people are coming from difficult situations, put in an even more difficult situation, And there's no, and anybody that had kids, the system back then would just kind of deny it. I mean, there was no program, there was no, I don't even think they had parenting classes or, I mean, it really was atrocious. I mean, looking at it now from an adult perspective, you know, I mean, it was criminal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I had my first child when I was actually in Green Hill, and my daughter, and I really wanted to be there for her. I really wanted to be able to shape her mind at a young age, or even her mom's mind, as far as me being there and me not being able to be there, just really put me in a position like over the next, through my life, I've had more children, and I've not been able to be there because of the prison system. And I'm not blaming the system. Like when I was a juvenile, like I couldn't change my life, but my options really are limited. So I haven't been able to take advantage of a lot of things, and I've missed out on a lot. And I don't know if it's because my mom didn't be able to come. She didn't really visit me when I was up there, Matt. I don't think your mom came that much. Casey, I don't know if you had that much visitation, but I didn't get many visitations, and I was there for a while, and I could count them on one hand. And it wasn't because she didn't love me or anything like that. It was, like I said, we come from, you know, a poor family. It's hard for her to get off on a Saturday to come all the way up here 4 hours, and who's going to watch my brother? And, you know, so there was always circumstances why she couldn't come, but it's kind of shaped me to believe that, you know, as far as the system goes, the way to beat a system is to with one of your own. So if you have a support system, and that's what I try to be for my children as far as family, I'm there for them no matter what. And that's the thing that I try to preach. I might not be there physically all the time, but I am there for you mentally and spiritually. I've always got their back, and I want them to know that. And if any families are out there and they have people who are incarcerated, adult, or, you know, just give them that, any kind of support will let them know that it can be all right.
Mm-hmm. So how did making the movie change your lives? And I want to hear from all four of you on this.
I'll start.
Yeah.
It gave me something to reflect back on. There were a lot of things in my life that maybe I didn't choose to or want to remember, or I pushed down naturally. Having a constant video mirror, for lack of a better way to put it there, from your adolescence until the point you grow up past 30 years old gives you something very tangible to look back at and hold on to, which has definitely aided me along in the process, as well as knowing Heather has changed my life. Became like a mom, so that's amazing.
Oh, this is Joe. For me, it really gave me, I don't know if it's something to be proud of, but I'm really proud of where I'm at today opposed to where I was, and me being able to see where I came from and why I got here and how I got here really helps me to know where I want to go in the future.
This is Matt. It has been like a video diary, or Casey was referring to as almost like a video mirror. The times you kind of wish wasn't there. You kind of, at times I thought, God, what did I agree to here? Being forced to kind of look back and think of, you know, realize some of the stuff you were saying or the things you were going through, or just, you know, how you were processing things back then. But overall, I mean, if you think about it, it was a program that should have never been. That slipped through, and it managed to affect my life. And, you know, we ended up being, what, 4 out of however many people were there at that time. So, in a way, it was like a lottery, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it should be like that, you know. You shouldn't have to hit the lottery in the juvenile system to grab the coattails of some program, you know, that should be offered to everybody. Not necessarily this program, but a program.
Yeah. Well, I would say, yeah, while all of you were doing your changes, that the film gave me an opportunity to change as well. It totally expanded my worldview. I mean, it's very easy for middle-class people to be in their bubble. I'm white, so I have some privilege there, that without saying more than that, it's obvious. And I realized, you know, it gave me a much, much deeper understanding and empathy for how hard it is for people who don't have the means to make their lives go forward. I mean, you just take one little falling out, you know, your car breaks down, therefore you can't get to your job, therefore you lose your job, therefore you can't take your kid to childcare. You know, it just cascades down the wrong way. And that was really what the point of the film is called, Minor Differences, is that I saw these guys and I knew they were not different from my son in many, many ways. Their advantages, their opportunities, their ability to have more than one person breathing down their necks all the time, I know that helped because my son did knucklehead things too. So I really learned a lot and have grown, I think, probably in equal measure as they have.
Is there anything that you would have liked the film to highlight that it didn't? I mean, I am sure editing was very tough to make decisions about what stayed, but, you know, and I want to hear from, I mean, all four of you again, if you have thoughts about that. So, Heather, why don't you start off, though?
Well, I was thinking about that question, and I think that if I had had more time, money, resources, you know, we could have done a series. I would have liked to have, because I interviewed a lot of people, their family members, and I would have liked to have gotten their perspective because there were some very, very poignant and articulate understandings of what it, the impact it has, incarceration has on families, especially when you have kids that are going into a system like that. So I would have liked to have included them. Someone else?
This is Joe. I like the film. Maybe the one thing I think could be in there more is just like the ramifications of locking juveniles up at a young age and seeing the effects like over time. Like here I am, I'm 35 years old and, you know, just now realizing that going back to school, I can go back to school and be a part of society. So I really wanted to film to say more to that, even though I say it a lot. Even though, I say it enough.
This is Matt. I just for me, the film, I would, my biggest hope really would just be that it begins the discussion for people, whether they're already are involved in the discussion or they've never thought about it. That if nothing else, this, you know, adds to the current discussion going on or begins it for some people. You know, I mean, the facts are the facts. There's currently 2.3 million Americans in custody. You know, one in every 32 Americans are involved with the justice system in some shape, form, or fashion.
This is Casey, 64% of which I think are drug offenses, so we're technically the majority of our incarcerated citizens are sick citizens. So I think the movie was perfectly done. It was done over almost two decades. So I don't know if it could have been any more perfect or could have hit on anything else. No, I think it said everything that needed to be said. It's just up to our people out there to open their ears and their eyes and listen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that does seem to be happening. That's the beauty so far. I mean, really, we intended to make this film, I think, all of us, without really talking about it. But as looking back, I see that it's really putting a human face on all those statistics, 2.5 million, 64% of this and 12% of that. We can easily shrug that off. But when you really meet someone, and one of the comments I get all of the time, which is a real tribute to these guys, is they say they are so real, and people cry. And I showed it at a prison in Purdy, in women's prison, and they cried. It didn't matter that they were men. It was the situation they were in. And I think it really speaks across the board to a lot of people emotionally, and that's where I hope change comes from. So
let's get back into sort of sharing some ideas of how we can improve things and doing what you're saying, really sort of opening people's eyes to some of the issues. And two things that have been brought up in this discussion already is the difficulty in sort of after your release and reentering that you know, you're not prepared for anything. Matt, you talk about that you don't even feel you're a part of society, that you felt old and tired at 32. So, you know, maybe you can explain that feeling, where it comes from, what it is like after, you know, your reentry, if that word even means anything, you know, the release, and maybe some thoughts about how we can try to improve things.
I sound like a broken record over here with programs, but once again, more programs, effective ways to have people reenter society. A lot of people weren't even really a part of society when they went away. You know, they were on the fringe of society to begin with. So it's, you know, how do you get these people involved, you know, in any kind of positive fashion when maybe they haven't done that up yet to this point in their lives? And that's a difficult nut to crack. And there are some smarter people than me out there working on that problem. I just don't think there's enough of them working on that problem.
Well, do you think part of it is you get out of jail? Traditionally, it's been, you know, the $40 and see you later. That's not enough to live on or even exist on for a day, practically, if you don't have a job. Isn't it all about employment, at least at some level?
Yeah, and the programs that they do have out there are pretty ineffectual. I guess that's the problem. The things that they do have, you know, they'll have the job fairs, and you'll go in there, and they send you to a job fair. And I remember this. I was at the halfway house. So they sent me to a job fair. The whole halfway house, that anybody that wasn't employed had to go to this job fair. And we got there, and not one of the employers there would hire a felon.
Goodness.
But that's just, that's just a small example of how the system works.
Well, maybe you can expand on that. I think assume a lot of times, if they're not living in this, in a world where they're working on these issues, that once you're rehabilitated or you've done your time under a conviction, then, you know, you've served your time and you're free to move on with your life, right? And there's something that we call at least collateral consequences, and that is actually what our next show is going to focus on as well, that there is an ongoing impact. So I don't know if anyone wants to talk about that.
Well, this is Joe.
Casey.
Go ahead, Casey.
Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. Well, this is Joe, and my thing as far as when you get out of prison, and Matt, like Matt said, there's no programs or anything. If you have ever looked at your own job application, the wording, just the wording on there, it used to be, have you ever been convicted of a felony in a past certain amount of years? Now they word it, at least up here, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Have you ever pled guilty to a crime? Now, it doesn't ask you, you know, if it's a felony. They don't even care. It just says a crime. So they're already putting you in a bracket where you can't just get out and get a job. You just can't do any of those things. So the most people don't need to realize that when you get out of prison and you're trying to do something with your life, you're going to have barriers. And
that's when the real sentence begins. Anybody can
exactly.
go do time. It's not hard to go sit in a box and twiddle your thumbs or do whatever it is you're going to do. The real sentence begins when you get out, because then you have to deal with no housing. You have to deal with no job. You have to deal with all of the realities of that past that's not going to go away.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Casey. I wanted to mention, this is something I recently ran into when I moved back into Washington. I tried to rent an apartment at an Essex property, which is a big corporate company, and now they actually will deny you rental of an apartment based on a felony conviction. So that's becoming more widespread. Pretty soon you won't even be able to rent a place to live.
Yeah, I mean, all the chips are against you when you come out of prison. I mean, even when you go, even in Washington State, you get fined for committing crimes, and you have to pay those fines while you're in jail. So while you're working for 22 cents an hour, some of that money goes to those fines that you accumulated. But as soon as you get out of jail, you have to pay those fines. So you've got debt accumulating that does not go away. and they give you no opportunity to even get out of their debt. And we're not talking about any debt you might have accumulated trying to, you know, get a loan or anything. We're talking about just Department of Corrections debt. You have to get, and once you get out of their debt, then you have to worry about any other debt that you have. So, I mean, everything is stacked against you, and there's nothing to combat that. There is no livable wages, jobs out here for people who are ex-felons, and so they almost immediately go back to what they know. And that's the sad part about it, because we don't know anything else. Felons don't know anything else besides crime, and the system doesn't put it in place for them to know anything else. I could see if I was a skilled, a master welder. I went to prison, became a welder, got out of jail, said, I can't find any job. we paid for you to be a welder. How come you're not doing that? Then they would have an argument. There's no argument as far as the system goes.
Yeah.
So, Heather, you when you talked about Travis, you really talked about he's reconnected with his culture, and so I didn't know if anyone has anything they want to add about the role of culture in building resiliency in kids so that they don't enter into the system, or a place maybe in it has in rehabilitation.
I think that kind of goes to, I mean, that every youth that is going to play some partial part of their growing up, you know, is who are you, where do I come from, what's my identity, you know. And so anywhere you could have, that would be kind of where mentoring could really be helpful, you know, to help kids, you know, this is what different cultures are and what, you know, what the history is and what your identity is. And that's kind of non-American, really. But I think that would be all
equal.
having your Irish heritage, did that help you sort of feel like you were part of something either before or after?
Yeah, definitely. And it gave me, you know, different things to read and things to learn about. And that, you know, I think that could play across the board and, you know, be a positive thing for most people.
Yeah, well, I think that it occurs to me that without some sense of community, however that's defined, whether it's your gender, your ethnicity, your involvement in a sport or something bigger than that, that is what helps people stay out when all these other barriers are there. So one or two people can help somebody get started. And that isn't that hard for the general public if you just pick any issue. And if let's say you're, I don't know, a Girl Scout or you're whatever, I don't know what the equivalent would be, but you know, go to your church. Faith-based groups do a lot of work. Andy has been helped extremely by that. There's a lot of people willing to help. They don't always know how, but the cultural, ethnic, and special interests are a way that communities can, I think, reach out. So having some identification would help.
So a lot of you have been talking about mentoring, and Joe, in the film, you talk about deep down everyone wants to change. What messages do you want to pass on with youth who may be listening in, or, you know, parents who are listening in, who are concerned about their children, who really want to make changes in their life but don't know where to begin or don't have hope?
The only message that I really like to portray is that, I mean, if you care enough or love enough about your child or the safety of his friends or anybody's child, just take a interest in what they're doing and support them. Support them for whatever reason, whatever they go through. Just support them and try to get them to realize that they need to start thinking outside the box, thinking bigger. That's the one thing that I wish I could have got a grasp on when I was in the system. I could have been like Casey and been one and done, but, you know, I didn't think bigger. I didn't think that, you know, 2 years from now is not a long time. 3 years from now is not a long time. So if you're, you know, 16 or 15, you know, you're going to be an adult soon. So you need to start thinking about what you can do with your adult life. And that might be what the parents might need to start thinking for their children, is let them know that, you know, it's not that far away. I didn't realize how soon time came until I started doing time. So that's the one message I have for them.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Just to get involved, you know, as much as you can. I mean, I know lots of times there's a disconnect between kids and parents, but get involved as much as you can, you know. And this is one of those cases where what you don't know can hurt you, for sure.
Gosh.
And support groups, because, I mean, this, sometimes relationships are formed in places like prison and they're not good, but this was a good relationship that was formed between us. So we kind of help each other out, you know. Me and Matt, and Heather and Casey, we really try to make sure that we don't go through as many struggles as, you know, as we portray on the film. Even though they're there, the struggles are there, we want people to realize that, you know, with a little bit of support, that, you know, you can make it. But everybody doesn't have that support. Everybody doesn't have a Heather, you know. So that's the one message I'd like to say.
This is Casey. I think that's what it all comes down to, is a support system. You look in the video way back to when we were first in Green Hill. You were looking at people that were completely alone and, like it's been said, in a box. And as the years progress, we've developed communities and people around us and things to help us function in a normal society. I don't think people do these things because they want to go to prison. They're doing it because they don't know any better, especially kids. Kids don't make these decisions because they want to see themselves die on death row someday or get 55 years like, you know, Travis. It's not a reasonable way to look at your future. So obviously there's some kind of disconnect. There's something going wrong in the kid's brain. And if that's their outlook, it's up to the adults that are around them to take them, grab them, and turn their view into a different direction and find something better.
I think, too, that kids being kids, we were all there once, you know, we're impulsive and we listen to our peers. And so by having stories, I know that when this film is shown to young people, they really relate to these, to the fact that they were, the characters in the film are young once, like themselves, and then they reveal what has happened to them. And more often that goes back to, you know, you don't know what's going to happen in 2 or 3 years, but it does ring true. And having that perspective is something that if young people can give to each other. If they are doing well, they need to reach out to the kids who think these gang members will be their friends when they go to jail. Well, it turns out that's not true. They don't come to visit. They're not your friends. But they, you know, kids don't know that. So adults have to step in, and it's our communities. It's not really just the kids. I guess that's what I'd like to throw my 2 cents in, is as a community, incarceration and all of these secondary things, that's a public health issue, if you ask me, when you have this many children being shunted off in grammar school into the, you know, kind of pipeline of jail because they act out in school. It's now a crime.
Mm-hmm.
Those sorts of things really, just the community has to take responsibility for what we do with our kids, bottom line.
Oh, and before I get to, I think, my last question, Heather, I just wanted to, do you have anything you want to say about maybe to other artists in your community, how to help sort of shine a light on this problem and the use of art in the context of social justice?
Well, yeah.
That was a big question, but you know.
Yeah. Well, I would just want to send a big shout out to the art funding community, because there hasn't been one social justice group or organization that has ever funded this film. It was funded by individuals and arts organizations. And I think it's because as artists we believe in the creative potential for change on anybody. And so artists are the perfectly suited people to work with anybody to help them see themselves differently and give a, a voice to the marginalized in this culture. And there's 100 ways to approach that. So I would, more and more artists are getting involved in what's called the social practice. I mean, as though that were something that didn't exist before. It used to be artists were all involved in their communities doing everything with everybody. And then it became this sort of white cube experience. And I think that's changing. There are a lot of artists working in communities all over the country and in the world. So I think it's a very rich place to work with other creative people, kids or otherwise.
So, you know, Travis, when we were talking about mentoring, he is really trying to reach people while he's in with the other prisoners. And he says that the one question that seems to make a difference is asking them how do they want to be remembered. Mm-hmm. So I ask that question of all of you. How do you want to be remembered?
That's a hard one.
Well, this is Joe. I'd like to be remembered as a guy who's been down but not out and made something of himself despite all the things that I've been through. You can be a success story. That's what I'd like to be remembered as.
Yay.
To keep fighting, no matter what. Matt, how do you want to be remembered?
I'd like to even, A, be remembered, and then B, be remembered in a good light, because that means the side that I was on won.
Right.
Because anybody painted positively in the, you know, in the history books was on the victorious side.
Casey?
I think I would like to be remembered as someone who affected some kind of change. I don't know if it's change with one person or maybe just change with one person's one thought, but somebody that affected some kind of change in this world. I think that's the only way we can really become immortal. Change somebody's mind, change an idea, change a pattern. That's how I want to be remembered, for change.
Okay. Heather?
Well, I think that's a hard one, but I would like to be thought of as loyal and trustworthy friend. I have learned a lot about myself and other people, and I know that if I didn't know the guys in this film, I would not be the same person. So I hope they remember me after I'm long gone.
Well, for people who want to learn more about the film, they can go to minordifferences.com. Casey, Heather, Joe, and Matt, thank you so much for being here. This has really, truly been wonderful.
Thank you.
And
yeah.
I know it's made a difference in your lives, but the bravery in sharing your stories has made a difference in a lot of people's lives. As I indicated, our next show will focus on collateral consequences for youth who have been involved with juvenile court. And to stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. So take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth.
Bye, Lauren. Thanks.
Bye-bye.